It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll get the story behind a major collaboration between the state and UW-Madison aiming to close the achievement gap in Wisconsin schools.
First, we heard last week about the State Department of Justice investigation into potential crimes committed at the Lincoln Hills School for Boys, a juvenile correctional facility. Since then, broader claims of increasing misconduct in all of Wisconsin's prison system have surfaced.
Writing about it for Gannett, Wisconsin Media's investigative team is reporter Keegan Kyle, who joins us now to talk about what he's learned. Keegan, welcome back.
Thanks.
Well, writing for the Post-Crescent, you've said that you wrote that the best answer we currently have on the trend of increasing misconduct is maybe. What have you found?
Yeah, it's kind of unclear exactly what direction misconduct has been going. There have been claims for months, primarily from prison guards and the prison guards union, that misconduct throughout the prison system has been a problem, but there isn't any really good data out there to back it up. So that's kind of what I've been looking into, is what data is there and what do we know about it?
All right. So you said not a lot of good data to back it up. So what data did you use?
Well, whenever there's like a major incident within a correctional institution, guards will usually write this thing called an incident report. It can be about anything. It can just be informational, but they're usually reports that are given to supervisors. And one of the types of reports that they can file is a misconduct report. So we looked at how many of these types of reports have been filed since like 2012, and they have been rising slowly over that time.
So you said they've been rising slowly over that time. Now, back in September, though, Gannett asked prison officials to review these misconduct-related incidents. And at the time, what showed up?
It was going up. If you look back to like 2012, there were around 1,200 of these misconduct reports. We were up to 1,500 last year. And this year, it appears to be going up as well, you know, comparing like the first 9 months of this year to last year. So that trend is definitely going up. Now, whether it actually means that there's a rise in misconduct throughout the prison system is a little less clear, because there are a bunch of caveats with these reports. One report doesn't necessarily mean just one incident of misconduct. The officer could be writing about a bunch of incidents or a bunch of different violations. So it's not really a consistent method to look at misconduct in the prison system. But right now, it seems to be the best information that we actually have.
When we talk about misconduct, what kinds of things are we talking about?
That was another thing that the correctional institutions kind of talked with us about, is that these misconduct reports can be about a really wide range of things. It can be something that's just, talking bad to your superior. It could be something that's really trivial, or it could be something that's much more serious and doesn't fall into another category of incident report. So they have separate ones that are specifically for like assaulting another inmate or assaulting an officer. And this category of misconduct is more like a catch-all for all the other types of misconduct that don't fall into those more clearly defined ones.
And you talked about this a little, but it sounds as though this is imperfect, for one thing, because there could be multiple reports filed about a single incident. So that would be misleading then when you're looking at the data, right? How did you deal with that?
Yeah. I mean, when I wrote about the data, I tried to write about it in the way that, like, this is a really tenuous set of data that we have, but right now it's the best information that we have to go on. And I think it does add context to at least what the guards have been talking about. You know, there is some data within the institutions to support what they've been claiming. Now, I think you can definitely question kind of the validity or the strength of it, but at least for now, this is the best we have to go off of. And it, I think, is a good starting point for drilling deeper into this topic of whether there is a broader problem with misconduct in the prison system.
We're talking with Keegan Kyle right now, investigative reporter for Gannett, Wisconsin Media, who looked at claims that misconduct is becoming increasingly common in Wisconsin's prison system. So we're talking about the way the data could be misleading, but if there is, as you found, a steady increase in misconduct-related reports being filed, isn't that proof, in a way, that there is increasing misconduct? Is it that simple?
Yeah. I mean, for now, the best that we have is that the data backs up what the guards have been saying. But there are claims that this data is not valid. So we have to, keep that in mind while we continue researching. I think we said it's a maybe because this data isn't perfect until we get some more clear picture. Then I think I would feel comfortable saying that there is or there isn't a trend of this. Like I said, I think it's a good starting point to kind of have this conversation about whether there is this broader trend in the prison system, but it's not a done question at all.
And what did officials make of the findings, the things you wrote about?
You know, they're looking into it as well. I think they're interested to see if there is a rise in misconduct. So, you know, we first contacted them about this back in September and requested this data. And now we're in discussions with them again to see if there are additional layers of data that we can look into. You know, one of the problems and that makes the correction system really complicated is that there are so many different institutions under so many different managers. And the correction system itself hasn't become really data-driven like a lot of modern institutions. You know, they still use paper for a lot of things. And so if you look at trying to track misconduct in all of these institutions to get like a statewide figure, it can quickly become a lot of work. So that's just one thing that makes this type of project really, really intensive. It's not as simple as you might think of just going into this database and looking at how many misconduct reports have been filed. If you want to actually drill down into them, you could be talking about reviewing thousands and thousands of pages of paper.
Well, if you say that the data are not perfect and the Department of Corrections officials say the data are not perfect, does that mean then that they're going to be looking at a different way to sort this out that will be more accurate and reliable and trackable?
Yeah, I mean, the question that I asked them and which we wrote about was, at this time, do you have any better data than this incident report data? And so far, they have not provided any better data. So, you know, I think what we've been doing is trying to talking with them about, are there other forms of data that might give us a picture at the amount of misconduct in the prison system?
And do you think this story is going to continue to uncover more issues of concern? You say it's a beginning point. What would be next?
Well, I think there are two kind of themes of conversation that are going on in the state right now. One is very specific to the Lincoln Hills investigation, which is about, you know, what are the specific allegations that went on in that institution. The second one is much broader, which is, does that institution represent broader claims of problems in the system, or is it an isolated allegation? And I think any kind of data that we can collect from the prisons to try to look at both Lincoln Hills itself and the broader institution would be really helpful in trying to understand what's going on and whether there are things that need to be fixed.
Keegan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Keegan Kyle, investigative reporter for Gannett, Wisconsin Media, who's investigating claims that misconduct is increasingly common in Wisconsin's prison system.
Researchers from the State Department of Public Instruction and UW-Madison are teaming up to take on Wisconsin's achievement gap, with the state among the worst in the nation in many measures of disparities between white and black students.
The state received a federal grant for more than $5 million to research what works and what doesn't work for helping students achieve across all racial and economic backgrounds.
Joining us now to talk more about the collaboration is Jared Knowles, research analyst for the policy and budget team of the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Jared, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Eric Grodsky, Associate Professor of Sociology and Educational Policy Studies. He's the lead researcher for the Wisconsin Center for Education Research. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, let's start looking at this grant. Jared, can you tell us what kind of research and work this grant is going to help the state do?
Yeah, the idea of this grant is to build on some work that the state superintendent was leading to look for school districts in Wisconsin that are showing success closing the achievement gap. And so we did an initial analysis and some initial work, and then we thought, when this grant opportunity came up, to write an application to sort of extend this to find where schools are closing the achievement gap. There's a lot of school districts that are making progress, and to figure out what they're doing, and then work with researchers to help us make sure we did that correctly, and to make sure that we can scale that up and see what's working.
So, Eric, how do you start a process like that, finding the schools? I guess we already know some of the schools that are having success in the numbers anyway. How do you start trying to figure out what the magic is at those schools that might be working?
So Jared and DPI got us started down this path, thankfully. So we'll build, as Jared said, on what they've done. We're going to look at the data that Wisconsin's collected over the years and use those data to figure out what schools seem to be especially effective in reducing disparities in achievement between African-American, Latino, and white kids, and also by income. Once we have that analysis done, we're actually going to go out to some of these schools and look at schools that are more typical and schools that seem to excel in reducing those gaps. And from that, we're going to try to develop a statewide survey to figure out how widespread promising practices are.
And how to point a finger at a particular practice that's making a difference. I mean, there's so many variables. You might be looking at the background of the students, the income levels, things like that, that a school might not have control over. How do you isolate out something that a school, and I know you're just starting to do this now, but what are you looking for? What kind of things might you be able to isolate out that you could then port to other school districts?
So the way we're going to choose the schools to look at more carefully is matching them on some of those characteristics.
Oh, okay.
And so we fully expect that some schools that serve large numbers of economically disadvantaged kids will be doing quite well by those kids, and others will be doing worse. And so it's a good point. I think the key is to find similar schools that are having very different experiences.
Let's dig a little more into the problem that we're trying to solve here, Jared. Tell us a little more about the achievement gaps, where we are in Wisconsin right now.
I think State Superintendent Tony Evers has really put a fine point on it. He has described the Wisconsin achievement gap as extraordinarily horrible. I think that says it all. We lead the nation in the achievement gap for black and white students, in standardized test scores, in graduation. We suspend black students at the highest rate relative to white students. So our Hispanic students do slightly better, but not enough better. And so we have been very good. The state superintendent has been very good about saying equity is the biggest issue facing the state right now, and we're not going to hide from the numbers.
And the idea behind this particular research is, let's not just try anything. Let's try to find something that has proven to be effective, at least in some of our schools.
Yeah, I think earlier you got to the point that the idea is not that one practice is all we need to apply across the state. What we need to do is to build a system in which we can identify the practices that target specific problems. So in one school, it may be that their low-income students have trouble getting to school on time, and so they have an attendance problem. In another school, it may be that they have justice issues and they're suspending too many minority students. You don't have the same solution to those problems. So we need this grant to build a system for which we can match schools' diagnosed problems up with solutions that have a research base behind them.
And then obviously the hope would then be to take these, figure out a way to put them into practice at comparable schools. So this is a long research project. In a way, that's step one.
Yeah, and in a way, the department has sort of been building toward this for the last several years, because we've been trying to build a platform for schools to collaborate around these kinds of issues. So it's a place where teachers can look up resources that apply to the problems that they see in their classroom. Principals can find solutions for problems that apply in their school. The idea is to use the great resources of the University of Wisconsin and this partnership between DPI and UW to put practices in there that have a research base behind them and that educators will believe in because they've been used in Wisconsin. And I think that idea that having a common place to put that now allows us to realize the vision of the Wisconsin idea of bringing the university to each of the schools in the state of Wisconsin.
And this sounds like it'll be useful in 4 years or so. Are there also efforts going on now, maybe without that research foundation, to try to tackle the problem for the kids who are in the schools now?
Yes, right now schools can look up what's called Promoting Excellence for All, which is the state superintendent's initial project on this that we used as the foundation for the grant. And in there, the state superintendent collected practices that were being used in the schools that we identified as closing the achievement gap and that educators identified as what they thought seemed to be working. And so right now we've been doing a lot of work around that at DPI, and there's sort of four broad areas of things that schools can consider to do. And that's sort of the foundation we're going to use to jump off from and hopefully expand upon as we move forward with the research with UW.
We're talking about Wisconsin's achievement gap and a new effort to help close that gap between white students and minority students, particularly African-American students in schools around the state. We have Jared Knowles with us in the studio. You just heard his voice there. He's with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Also here, Eric Grodzki. He's with the Wisconsin Center for Education Research. Well, this is a big project, Eric, 4 years, right, as I understand it.
Yep.
How do you start to operationalize this? How do you start to get on the ground and doing this research from what we know from DPI so far?
Yeah, and we're eager to do that. I think the point I want to come back to, Jared highlighted, is Wisconsin has some wins in this area. As bad as the numbers are, there are schools that are doing things that are effective for educating all our kids. And so the starting point is using the data we have, as I said, to try to figure out which schools those are. You know, there's also a lot of research out there that we can draw on. This is part of the strength of the university, both the Wisconsin Center for Education Research and the Institute for Research on Poverty, who's also partnering on this grant. So we've got a strong knowledge base on which we can draw, I think. Putting our resources together with DPIs, we'll be able to make pretty good progress on this.
Have you done anything like this at your center, Eric, working with the state on a big statewide project like this?
So the center's got about 50 years of history, and I have about 3 years there.
Okay.
So I'm sure there have been other substantial partnerships with the state. This one, I think, is different right now in that it's really a partnership where we're bringing complementary resources to bear on achievement disparities. So it's an issue that a lot of people are concerned about. It's an issue that the university and the department have invested in, and I think it's a relationship that will probably benefit kids to come for several years.
And Erica, forgive me for getting a bit wonky here, but I'm trying to picture what this research looks like. I mean, are we handing out surveys to all the first graders for 4 years, or what do researchers, and I assume there are multiple answers to this, but what are you going to be doing in the actual schools?
Yeah, so the hope is that once we identify these schools, we'll go out, we'll have some focus groups with students, we'll talk with teachers, we'll have some discussions with administrators to try to understand what makes the school tick, what challenges they confront, how they overcome those challenges. And then ultimately we do want to survey practitioners in the state to see if, for example, the practices that are identified in the Excellence for All report are widespread and effective across the state, or if they just reflect circumstances in the particular schools that DPI was able to talk to.
And Jared, I want to bring you back. And now you mentioned the Excellence Project that's already trying to tackle some of these problems and will probably be informed by this research. You mentioned some of the four different main areas you're trying to cover there. Can you just give us a broad strokes what you're focusing on?
Yeah, what the task force of teachers and principals that the state superintendent and superintendent of Mequon-Thiensville Public Schools, DeMond Means, assembled, what they identified was effective instruction, and there's strategies that allow teachers to, or tell teachers what sort of effective instruction might look like, student-teacher relationships, family and community engagement, and school and instructional leadership. And if you look at the DPI's website, we have a e-course that we're putting out that schools can use and work through with their staff to go through the specific strategies in those areas.
And are you hoping, especially with that training element, that sounds like where this research could really make a lot of difference and inform what you're doing already?
Yeah, the idea is both to increase the number of high-level things, I think, that are there, so we have more than four, and to make sure that we've identified the correct strategies in each of those categories and that we can point to actual rigorous research that supports them that's been done in the state of Wisconsin. Because the sort of in our backyard thing is very important for educators to have that external validity to say, yeah, it might have worked in Chicago public schools, but we're not Chicago. And so we can say, but it works in Wisconsin and you are Wisconsin.
If I can speak for more skeptical or cynical listeners for a moment, people might be thinking, okay, we've got a problem, and here's government agencies doing some research, and they're going to come out with a report. How do you make sure you keep the eye on the ball here and make sure that you take something, learn from it, and put it into practice?
It's a great point. I think we're doing a lot more than a report, and that's a really big component of the grant. DPI has had about $22 million invested in its data systems to communicate with schools and to collect information on schools and report it to the public and to the schools. That platform is sort of the foundation that we can now use to disseminate the findings from the research directly to educators. So not a report that we put out and have a press release in Monona Terrace and everyone walks away feeling good, but really it will show up when teachers are looking at how their students are doing. The idea is that the research practices will be right there and they'll say, hey, it looks like you're having attendance challenges. These are research-based practices that we know work.
And Eric?
Yeah, and another piece of this grant actually funds the Wisconsin Education Research Network from the Wisconsin Center for Education Research. And that's a group whose primary business is to get together with people in the field, with educators, put them together with researchers, and really do the translational work on both ends so that researchers can hear more about what people in the field are seeing and experiencing, but also so that the folks who are doing the educating out there can learn more about what people in the research side are finding.
Now, you mentioned a strong research base out there in the state. I imagine people around the country are working on these issues. As you start to go toward this project, are you looking for what people around the country have done, just for some baseline research for things to look for?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's some of the work that we've done at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research, is sort of reviewing what other folks have tried, what's been effective, what's been ineffective. One of the things I'm really struck with is the importance of relationships across agencies. And so one of the things that we'll be looking at the schools is the extent to which they partner with neighborhood or community organizations, the extent to which social services are engaged. Some of this is coming to a head in Milwaukee and in Madison in the form of community schools. And so that's another thing that we'll be thinking about.
And Eric, Jared mentioned that, in effect, this is priority one for education. If we had to pick one problem to solve, this is probably it. Do you see it that way, too, the racial disparities in achievement?
Yes, racial disparities and economic disparities both. I think those inequalities are real drivers of what's going to happen, not just to our kids now, but, of course, to their kids down the road. And so I think if we really want to maximize what we can from this country in terms of the talents of people and their productivity, we really need to address this.
Well, Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jared, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
We're talking to Jared Knowles from the state DPI, Eric Grodzki from UW-Madison, the Wisconsin Center for Education Research. They are involved in a big new project trying to figure out ways to solve racial disparities in achievement in Wisconsin schools.
We'll look at two pieces of news in the ongoing national conversation about police-community relations. A mistrial was declared yesterday in the trial of one of the officers in the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore. Also yesterday, the U.S. Department of Justice agreed to open a review of the Milwaukee Police Department.
The investigation comes at the request of Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn. Joining us now to discuss the investigation is John Diedrich of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Stan Stojkovich is also with us. He's dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. Stan, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Well, John, let's start and get the basics from you. We talked to Chief Flynn back in November, I think it was, when he asked for the Justice Department partnership. So we're not too surprised that this happened. But what did Chief Flynn have to say today about the Department of Justice saying, yeah, we'll take this up, we'll do this thing?
Well, he's pleased about it. Again, as you said, they sought this review, and there was some discussion earlier that there may be a pattern and practice investigation. That's a bit more adversarial in that the outcome of that is not voluntary. And we don't know really where that, how close that process came, but we do know that the police department here sought this review by the Department of Justice. They're really two separate processes, and this volunteer review really be a top-to-bottom all practices will be on the table. And the chief has said that he's confident that the practices of his department will uphold the scrutiny, that they'll look for places to improve, and that he looks forward to working with the Justice Department.
And when we look at this around the country, a lot of times we're talking about one or the other of these investigations related to a high-profile police shooting. Milwaukee, that was the shooting of Dontre Hamilton. This idea of doing this investigation came out after the federal government said they wouldn't pursue certain criminal charges. What is the reaction to this investigation, this review in Milwaukee with that Dontre Hamilton story in the background?
Well, the Hamilton family has supported a pattern and practice investigation, as well as other families of individuals who have had their rights violated. And most particularly, this discussion really jumped up when the discussion of the illegal cavity searches that were just settled here in Milwaukee. That was a case in which a number of individuals, dozens, sued successfully. There was a settlement from the city of Milwaukee that said that they were illegally searched. And so it was in the backdrop of all these cases that this concern has continued to mount. And so there is some sense that the concern is that the outcomes may not be required to be followed, that the Department of Justice can make these recommendations, but unlike the power of the court, they can't be forced. Though the Department of Justice, individuals who were in town today, Mr. Davis from the Department of Justice, noted that they think this is likely to be followed because the department, the city of Milwaukee, has sought this review, so that they're likely to follow any recommendations that they do come up with. But the families are watching, and they're going to keep a close eye on this process because because they really feel like deep scrutiny is needed.
And Stan, let's bring you in on this now. Two different types of reviews we're talking about. This voluntary one that Milwaukee is doing, one of, I think now it's eight or nine around the country. And then this more adversarial one, as John said. We've seen that in places like Ferguson, Missouri, Chicago now. What do you think tips the balance between this voluntary cooperative process and this outside more binding review process?
Well, what happens is if you create an adversarial relationship in a sort of pattern and practice investigation, that becomes much more protracted, potentially, much more devastating, much more costly. It's not clear that necessarily the outcomes from that would be beneficial, but it would require and would allow the Department of Justice to be very invasive in the practices of the police department. On the other hand, a collaborative approach is saying, police department saying, listen, we may have an issue. We're not admitting any kind of wrongdoing. We're saying we may have a practice, we may have some procedures in our past or even going forward that are questionable. We want your review. So we want to have a conversation, a dialogue with you. We want to work with you. We want to make the police department the best possible place. They have different types of aims in the pattern and practice approach. What you're really talking about, again, is much more invasive, and also a court, a potential special master, a lot of refiling of reports, much more adversarial. But this is much more, the collaborative approach is much more, listen, we're going to go forward and try to learn from this, and probably is a much more positive approach to things as we go forward. So we'll have to wait and see.
For the intent of these two different processes, this pattern and process report, this more adversarial one, is the idea here that, hey, this is more of a last resort. This is when we think we might have a broken police department here.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, this is nothing new. Many police departments over many, many years have really had this imposed upon them. It's the last ditch effort by the federal government or the Department of Justice to say, we've had enough of these types of practices. There's a pattern, there's a practice, obviously. We now want to rectify that, and it doesn't seem that you can do it by yourselves. So we're going to force you to do it. And I got to tell you, for a police department to go through this, this is like an organizational nightmare, largely because it is so invasive. You lose control of the police department, and the people may be around for years. The implications are very costly as a result. So you really want to avoid that. So I see the Milwaukee Police Department saying, listen, we don't want to go down that path, nor does the city of Milwaukee. I don't think anybody does. Let's be proactive. I think Chief Flynn is being proactive and saying, I'm going to go forward on this. And if I didn't do this, there may be this other, you know, thing hanging over my head that I don't want. So I think that this is a positive move on his part.
That's Stan Stojkovic from UW-Milwaukee. Also with us, John Diedrich of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at this new review, federal review of the Milwaukee Police Department, as requested by Chief Ed Flynn. John, talk us through, what do we know about the timeline on this this review? How long does it last? When will we be hearing results from it?
Well, it'll be at least 6 months, maybe a little bit longer. We heard today could edge closer to 8 or 9 months of an initial review process. And that's the way the federal authorities laid it out today. Though I should say that Chief Flynn indicated that they went through a review by a Wisconsin agency, basically in-state review that looked at their practices. And he feels like they've just gone through this process on a, you know, not at a federal level, but that he thinks it could happen faster in 6 months. But in any case, after this period, there'll be a public report that will come out as to what the recommendations are. And then what the individuals do from the Department of Justice is monitor how those recommendations are being followed for 18 months after that. And so there is a sort of a study and a recommendation period where the public will be informed after that. And then there'll be a monitoring period. And then after about 2 years, that's when it ends. Though, you know, again, this doesn't, to Stan's point, that this may have been done in part to send the message that we don't want a pattern in practice. This does not mean, though, necessarily that a pattern in practice could not come later. That has happened in some places. This would indicate that you know, maybe be less likely, but it's not necessarily off the board. Those two entities are different in the department. But and this was it to there was some history of this going back even prior to the cavity search investigation, which when this was being sought and discussed by the previous U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, James Santel, had asked for a preliminary investigation into the possibility of this. So this has been sort of talked about, and this is a proactive approach by the department that will play out over these 2 years, and we'll see if this stems off the possibility of that more adversarial approach. But it's not necessarily that can never happen in the future.
And Stan, John just mentioned a different process by a certification board. You just very recently wrote about that in Milwaukee. What happened there? What did we learn about the Milwaukee Police Department?
Well, this is a review process done, a professional accrediting body here in Wisconsin. It's the Wisconsin Law Enforcement Accreditation Group, of which I sit as one of the commissioners. I've been on the board since the year 2000, so roughly 15 years. We've seen literally dozens of agencies go through this process. Milwaukee volunteered about 2 years ago to say, we want to go through this process. We know it's laborious. We have 237 standards. In Milwaukee's case, being the largest police department in the state, required multiple teams, mobile assessment teams, a team leader, but really was led by a very well-respected police chief in the state of Wisconsin. They went forward. They came forward with a report. They got complete cooperation from the Milwaukee Police Department. As the chief suggested, it's intensive. And anybody who's gone through this process, it's not done overnight. It takes months. In Milwaukee's case, it's almost a two-year investment of time and effort and, you know, manpower to make this thing happen. So they came out in flying colors, quite frankly. None of us were really surprised, per se, because we knew that the chief was really open to this and was going to get this thing done. But it is a significant process, and most importantly, it's an ongoing process. Unlike the Department of Justice, where they may issue a report and then they may continue to monitor, accreditation is an ongoing process that an agency has to stick to, and the standards are revised, and they have to go through another accreditation. That's every 3 years. So we're constantly watching to make sure people stand up to the standards, and I think the police started with a very good posture on this a couple of years ago. The chief had the prescience to say, listen, I think that this is a good move, and we need to sort of invest in this and go forward.
That's Dan Stojkovic from UW-Milwaukee. He stays with us. John Diedrich from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel leaves us now to get back on a deadline. Thanks to him for joining us today. And now you can join in, too. Do you think the Milwaukee Police Department should get that more invasive, as our guests have called it, pattern and practice investigation? Do you think that the collaborative reform process that is happening will be enough?
And on a broader view, what do you think community members and police department officials should be doing to ensure that police officers are held accountable to protect and defend the public? Call 800-642-1234. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Stan Stojkovic about the U.S. Department of Justice Collaborative Reform Review of the Milwaukee Police Department.
We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are you hoping comes out of this review? And more broadly, what do you think about police-community relationships in your community, in your city, wherever you are around the state? What can be done to build stronger relationships? And if you are in the police department yourself, love to hear your perspective. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Stan, before we go to our callers, I want to put this all now in the wider context. Obviously, news all the time. We mentioned earlier the news out of Baltimore of flare-ups, cases involving police departments and minority communities. Do these kind of investigations we're talking about actually help build bridges between the police and the communities they serve?
Well, they're intended to do that, but that's not always the outcome. There's always numerous unintended consequences. In the Baltimore case, and in every case, you have to look at the particulars of that particular case or that particular community. But in Baltimore's case, my opinion is that they may have jumped too quickly to prosecute this police officer. They didn't have all the evidence. The case wasn't necessarily closed. There were concerns about people's knowledge of the basic evidence, the reports of the medical examiner. All these things complicate the issues. However, the larger issue is you have to look at, well, what is that relationship between the police and the community, particularly certain types of communities? Baltimore is a very diverse community. What is that relationship, and how can efforts going forward ultimately reform, if necessary, those relationships? How do we get better relationships? Because without citizens and citizen involvement, police activity is largely ineffectual, and good police administration, good police departments know that.
Well, it seems like there's two very radically different stories we hear a lot from people, especially protesting police departments, groups like the Black Lives Matter movement. They're saying, hey, we black people, especially in urban communities, feel targeted by police. Police departments out of control, unaccountable, very hard to bring charges, as in this case in Chicago. Police departments saying bad things happen. We're doing a tough job. We're feeling embattled by the communities that we're trying to serve and protect. How do you sort that out? Where do you see the reality?
Well, the reality really is that most of the communities, according to the research at least, do value their police departments. Police get very high marks among citizenry. Most citizens understand the difficulty that police are faced in. Now, having said that, certain communities, particularly in large urban centers, view the police as an invading army, as really not a participant in trying to solve crime. But that's not uniform either. So, I mean, as you can imagine, it's all over the place in terms of what's really happening. But at the end of the day, the police have to ask, how best do we serve and police these communities? It is not through fear, intimidation, and alienation. More often than not, when you have rogue police officers or police activities that are highly suspect or blatantly illegal, it is the police department that comes upon it and then takes the appropriate action. It's when they don't take that appropriate action that you start to see pushback and people saying, wait a minute now, we've got some real gross violations here and nothing's really being done about it. And most importantly, there is no communication about it. That is the death blow, I think, to a police department. So communities that experience that, they have the right and they should demand of their police the highest quality policing available. That is possible. Is it difficult? Absolutely. But they do have to demand that, because if they don't demand it, it will not be resolved.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have David on the line in Onalaska. David, hi.
Hello. My comment is, if we want to restore the community relations with police departments, it really needs to start with the public that interacts with these police departments. I've lived in Milwaukee. I've encountered police. And anytime I've ever had a situation with police officers, you have to start with treating them with respect. No, you don't want to be pulled over by the police. No, you don't want to have anything to do with the police. But when that situation occurs, it's always, you know, treat these police officers with respect. Yes, sir. No, sir. You know, follow their directions. And I think when you do that, you know, they're human beings just like everybody else. They're going to treat you with respect.
David, thanks a lot for bringing that up. And Stan, this is an argument we hear a lot when we talk about police and their communities. How big a part of the puzzle is that, the public should just treat officers with more respect when they encounter them?
Well, there's no doubt respect is, it's not a one-way street, though. Respect is two ways. The police department also should respect people, and we have policies and procedures to do that. When we see police officers disrespecting, it's usually around two issues. They're not trained well enough, and or their supervision is lax. Supervision, middle managers, sergeants in most police departments have the responsibility to make sure those officers on the street on a day-to-day basis are respecting the community, are following their training. More often than not, in crises, in bad situations, we find police officers either were not trained or were poorly trained or were poorly supervised. And it's those issues that the police chief and police commanders ultimately have to address.
David, thanks a lot for that call. So I wonder, when we have a police shooting in Wisconsin, a police-involved shooting in Wisconsin, there's now, thanks to a recent law, a state-run investigation of it. But it investigates just the circumstances of the shooting, it sounds like. Does there need to be a wider picture of, like as you said, the supervisor for that officer, the training of that officer?
I think, and that's what the Department of Justice ultimately will look at as well. You know, it's one thing to say that you, for example, have screened people so that they don't have certain psychological propensities that are really anti-community or they don't get along with people. That's one thing that, police departments do. But it's another thing to say, as they socialize as police, how are you monitoring that socialization? What are you doing to influence culture? What kinds of programs, not only training, but ongoing kinds of things that will allow us to supervise officers in an effective way? I think, for example, police accreditation, police professionalism is really about giving police the best possible tools, the best possible training going forward. And accountability, ultimately, at the end of the day, is what it's all about. Policing is a local thing. local communities. We have hundreds of police departments in the state of Wisconsin, for example. Each of them is different in terms of what they expect of their police. So we have to understand that within the community context. It's really in the large urban centers where you start to see controversy, where there are larger kinds of issues that overshadow policing, things like poor schools, poor health care systems, poverty issues, all those types of things really affect these communities differentially. And they're not, you don't expect a cookie-cutter response, but I do expect police to maintain professional standards, and good police departments do that.
Talking to Stan Stojkovic from UW-Milwaukee about police and policing. The starting point today, a federal investigation, Department of Justice investigation review requested by the Milwaukee Police Department of that department. Go back to our callers now. Ray is on the line with us in Milwaukee. Ray, hi.
Hi, I've lived here all my life. I'm 54 years old. I remember Harold Breyer. I remember Jeffrey Dahmer and the way the police mishandled that. They actually sent his last victim back to Dahmer to be killed, and those cops were never charged. We live in a society now where on the day Dontre Hamilton was killed, two Milwaukee police officers first came in contact with Dontre Hamilton in the park sleeping and determined that he was no threat. And then later that day, a single kind of crazy officer who we know from his past performances was a little unhinged, he approached Dontre Hamilton by himself and was threatened by a black man who said, "Don't be hitting me with your billy club."
Ray, I'm going to jump in because we're long time, and I want Stan to jump in on that point. You started with the idea that these problems, these concerns about police departments didn't start with Dontre Hamilton or the cavity searches that John Diedrich mentioned earlier. There have been complaints in decades, generations past. Are we still dealing with the same problems we used to, Stan?
Yes, we are, and we still have to deal with them. They're a day-to-day type of occurrence. In the Dontre Hamilton case, the officer wasn't fired by Police Chief Flynn because, you know, he shot the Mr. Hamilton 14 times. He was fired because he didn't follow policies and procedures. He should have never been there. And that's what I'm talking about. This is a vigilant thing. It's like exercising. You don't exercise for one day out of your life. It's a continual investment. That's what we have to do in police departments, is hold people accountable to modern standards of training as well as effective supervision. Once we do that, we have a much lower probability of having these kinds of horror stories.
I've seen the case, Stan, as we wrap up, that accountability and transparency, police departments sometimes or individual officers push, or unions push back on that. But ultimately, it's good not just for the community, but for the police themselves, because it helps build up that kind of trust that they need for the community. Is there a case there?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I've written about that. That the whole argument, the whole predicate of police activity is premised on effective policing being community partnering with the police department and working with the police department. Every police professional knows that, and it's the obligation of our police and our citizens jointly to make that happen.
And you're hopeful that this review will improve things in Milwaukee, though? Again, you're not saying this is a worst-case situation that needs that more adversarial review.
Right, and I don't believe in panacea solutions. There is no magic pill, no shot to take on this. This is a protracted effort, but I think taking this, making this overture by the police department was a very smart move, and I think it can help the police and the community in the long run.
Professor Stojkovic, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Have a great day.
That's Stan Stojkovic, Dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. We also had John Diedrich with us earlier from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Looking at this new review, the U.S. Department of Justice took up Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn's request to do a collaborative reform review of the police department there.